Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Keith Makoto Woodhouse. He's an assistant professor at Northwestern University, where he teaches in the History Department and the Environmental Policy and Cultural Program. We're talking about his book, The Ecocentrists, A History of Radical Environmentalism. Keith, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
This is a fascinating subject, and it's a very little known history. How did you piece together a history of radical organizations like this? Because that by its very nature means that a lot of stuff is not well known generally.
Right. That's true. And piecing it together was a sort of a combination of relying on the standard archives that all historians dig around in. Established archives that where librarians collect important materials, and we dig through those cartons and try to piece together a narrative from the past. In this case, groups like Earth First, which is the main organization that's featured in the book, they're not quite as present in those archives.
I can't imagine that they leave a great paper trail.
Yeah, well, you know, they actually do leave a great paper trail, not in the places that you might normally look. But lucky for me, Earth First was not only a group of activists who engaged in direct action and chained themselves to bulldozers and sat in trees and whatnot. They also wrote and talked endlessly. and so they published a journal called the Earth First Journal, which came out monthly and ran to 30, 40, 50 pages each issue. And they wrote a lot to each other. And so there is actually a considerable paper trail, but you just have to find it. The Earth First Journal, when I was originally writing the book as a dissertation when I was a graduate student, was hard to come by, and I had to sort of piece it together from various partial collections here and there. Now it's actually been posted online, it's great for future researchers. It makes my research look a little less impressive. Now it's all out there, but there's a website called the Environment and Society Portal where they've actually digitized the entire I think the run from basically the beginning of the journal in 1980 all the way through the mid-1990s, maybe even the late 1990s. But I also I tracked down Dave Foreman, who was the one of the founders of Earth First and who lives now in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and got in touch with him. And he is a remarkably generous person in terms of letting people look through, or at least letting he let me look through his materials. He is a sort of a historian's dream in that he's a pack rat in terms of paper and documents. So his garage is there's one or two walls that are stacked floor to ceiling with banker's boxes filled with documents. And he let me spend several days just rooting around. And so that was a huge resource as well.
The amazing thing is that nobody's put this history down in book form before. I mean, this is the first comprehensive history of radical environmentalists that I've read.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear you say that. I mean, I don't want to claim too much originality here, because there have been books, most of them by journalists who did a lot of work interviewing people and getting the story that way. But I think this is one of the first scholarly treatments.
That's what I meant. That's exactly what I meant.
Yeah. So there are some great books that were helpful for me. One of the main books about Earth First was a group called Coyotes and Town Dogs by a writer named Susan Zakin. And she mainly wrote that by actually going out and talking to the various individuals involved. Nice. And it's a really useful and a rich and important book. But it was more sort of just the blow-by-blow story. And very much from a very sort of sympathetic writer who was writing from a pretty Earth First friendly perspective. My book is not in any way a sort of an attack on Earth First, but it's a little bit more of a critical treatment, although I obviously have a great deal of sympathy for what the group was about.
I think more or less that it's an honest appraisal. The way that I came away from it is that it was more of a historian's approach to the material.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that. I wanted to get it sort of a group that I think is really important, and I wanted to get their story down, warts and all.
Now, we cannot possibly do justice to this book in a half hour, so we're going to be skipping around a little bit, and I want to say that for the benefit of the audience, because people who are interested in the history of environmental movements, and especially today, where these issues are now really coming to the forefront again and are very critical, I strongly recommend reading this book. One of the things you write about generally about radical environmentalism is that one of the most basic concepts was limits. I want you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, this to me is a pretty fundamental concept when you talk about and think about environmentalism, and certainly it has been for a lot of major environmental thinkers, maybe never more so than in the early 1970s when the environmental movement became, or at least a large sort of wing of the movement, really sort of organized itself, its thought around the idea of limits. And there was a really famous book, a report called The Limits to Growth, which by a group called the Club of Rome, which is a group of researchers organized by an Italian philanthropist. And they basically sort of constructed these computer models of the presence and the depletion of various resources through the 70s and the end of the century and into the 21st century. And so that idea of the limits to growth is sometimes called the limits to growth argument. Is pretty fundamental. The other major book at the time that really adopted this approach was The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich, which sort of was the other end, which was basically saying, you know, there's just too many people and the population of human beings is growing and growing. Now, critics of these ideas would say, rightly, that it's never just a numbers game, right? And simply looking at numbers alone is always a far too simplistic a story. But the idea that the planet is finite and resources on the planet are finite is, I think, remains a central idea in environmentalism.
And it remains a radical idea.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an idea that it's troubling. And it's problematic in all sorts of ways. It's led to a lot of some of the worst inclinations of the environmental movement have run with this idea, right? So you have immigration restrictionists and people who want to limit population in all sorts of dramatic and draconian ways. So that's I think is part of people's fear. I think very legitimate and justified fear about misuse of that idea of limits, of too many people and too few resources. And yet you can't completely escape the idea, right? I mean, it's
to
some degree.
That's right.
It's sort of a bedrock principle of the environmental movement.
It also just seems like a reality that we don't have an infinite planet. We have finite resources, and therefore things are finite.
Yeah, and you know, the more you look at sort of particular resources, it starts to become a question not only of when is this going to run out, but to what lengths will we go to keep using this particular resource. So, you know, the most obvious one that comes to mind is fossil fuels
and coal in particular.
What we're most wrestling with now, yeah. Right? Exactly, coal, and you know. For all intents and purposes, there's plenty of fossil fuels left on the planet. The problem is, I think, twofold. One is that it's harder and harder to get at them. So oil in particular, we have to dig deeper and deeper and go further and further out into the ocean to find the oil. We live in, you know, the age of what one writer has called the age of tough oil, where it's getting harder and harder to get it and more costly to get it in terms of dollars and human effort. And then, of course, the environmental cost of fossil fuels is greater and greater. And so it's not so much that we're going to run out of fossil fuels anytime soon, but it's that we're reaching various other forms of limits. The costs of getting it and using it are becoming too high.
What's amazing reading your book, though, is how often issues and arguments that are being used today in environmentalism were created back then. That these issues have a long history of people wanting to get, and it seems like the government was being responsive to them too, for a while, and then it went away, and you trace that history. I want to talk about I lived through this. 1969 was the rise of what's called the New Left. And as you mentioned in the book, we're not really sure how to define clearly the New Left. But one of the things you delineate in your book is the very troubled relationship between the New Left and the new environmentalism. Many of the political people on the New Left really were not into the environmental movement at all originally.
Right. And this was one of the things that I was especially interested in the book, was trying to trace the complicated and I think often tense relationship between environmentalism and what we might call social justice movements, many of which were at the center of the New Left. And, you know, it's easy to look back at that moment, the late 1960s, and think about civil rights and black power and feminism and gay liberation and environmentalism, and think of them as all sort of a piece, right? These were all movements that were that had come onto the scene, that were especially energized by young people and campus activism, et cetera, et cetera. But all of those movements had different histories and different players. And they were in various degrees of tension with each other, I think especially environmentalism and various other movements that were more organized around social justice and human freedom. I think the sort of real tension that I wanted to get at and think about, because I think it's something that's really difficult to wrestle with intellectually, is the fact that in some ways, one of the interests of environmentalism is in limiting human freedom.
Right.
Right. That's not really the language that we use. That's a pretty stark way of putting it. But to some degree, environmentalists want us to think about what we allow ourselves to do and the ways that we can actually restrain our actions and our impacts and our use of various resources. Preferably, we don't want to do that by fiat. But the basic idea is to actually restrain human action and human behavior, whereas I think a lot of other movements that we would think of as liberatory movements are based around the idea of maximizing human freedom.
Right.
And so that's a sort of a subtle but I think important tension that is easy to gloss over, but remains important.
I can remember at the time, because I was involved in several movements at the time, there was a lot of antipathy towards the environmental movement from social justice movements. There were people that tried to sort of bridge them, and you talk about them at length in the book. Murray Bookchin, in the concept of social ecology, seemed like that was an attempt to sort of draw a connection between the social justice movements and the environmental movements.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Bookchin is one of the major thinkers in that regard. And I think he's actually a thinker who really hasn't gotten his due. He was a very important thinker about issues of social justice, issues of political freedom and environmentalism as well. And he's just he's not a very familiar figure. He's not a household name for most people. But that intellectual movement that he started called social ecology was his attempt to, as you're suggesting, marry all of those things and say, look, these all have to some degree a root cause. And his basic claim was that misuse of non-human nature by human beings is rooted in human inequality and abuse of each other. So abuse of nature is rooted in abuse of people by each other. Bookchin was an anarchist, and so he believed fundamentally that hierarchy was one of the central problems with modern human society, and that if you could eliminate hierarchy and if you could gain sort of total equality, then environmentalism, sustainability, whatever you want to call it, would flow inevitably from that. Now he states that in a much, much more complicated way, right? He goes on for many hundreds of pages outlining the history of this and his theory of how this works in cities and rural areas and the political dimensions of it, etc. And it was really his life's work to try to make this argument. But that was sort of the nutshell claim that he made.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Keith Makota Woodhouse. He's an assistant professor at Northwestern University, where he teaches in the history department and the environmental policy and cultural program. And we're talking about his book. It is a dynamic history. I found it fascinating. The Ecocentrists, a history of radical environmentalism. Keith, what happens, and again, we're shrinking everything in the book. There are organizations like the Sierra Club who pretty early on decide to work with the government. And then there just seems to be an increasing series of disappointments, or where different factions within different environmental groups feel like we've given up too much. And there's an increased radicalization of segments of the environmental movement. And there's this philosophy of egocentrism that starts, or sometimes called biocentrism or deep ecology. Can you talk to me about where that comes from?
Yeah, so I think that the idea of ecocentrism wasn't called that, but you can trace it at least back to the 19th century and probably before. You know, you see echoes of it in the writings of Muir and Thoreau and Leopold and all of the major thinkers that environmentalists in the sort of canon of American environmental literature. But the basic claim is that human beings and non-human nature are of equal moral value. So essentially, you know, we should not privilege human beings in a moral sense above the rest of life on the planet. And it begins to become called ecocentrism or biocentrism in the 60s and 70s. One of the major thinkers is a Norwegian philosopher named Arne Naess, and his ideas are sort of adopted by various American thinkers. As you sort of gestures towards, it becomes especially important for environmentalists/conservationists who are increasingly dissatisfied with more sort of conventional methods of reform. So the environmental movement after Earth Day in 1970 has really remarkable success gaining a foothold in Washington, D.C. as a major public interest lobby. It's aided by many of the sort of important Nixon-era environmental laws that are passed.
Right.
The Clean Air and Clean Water Acts of that era, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, etc. And so you have all of these groups like the Sierra Club, Wilderness Society, NRDC, Audubon Society, that open offices in D.C. and engage in lobbying and litigation and really using these laws to great effect, which is hugely successful and heralds what, you know, some people call the environmental decade of the 1970s. But relying on the federal government and relying on conventional reform politics is always inevitably it's going to lead you to certain kinds of disappointment, and things are going to slow down. And it's because fundamentally it's a culture of compromise, right? That's liberal democratic.
And there are
politics.
People who just would not like. There are events like RARE 2, the Roadless Area Review and Evaluation, and the Forest Service, which just was sort of like the line in the sand for many environmentalists. And out of that comes that sort of out of that radicalization comes groups like Earth First.
Exactly. Right. So you have these activists who were increasingly dissatisfied with the pace of change and the record of success across the 1970s. And then RARE 2 in the late 1970s, this was the second attempt to inventory Forest Service wilderness. The first one was in the early 1970s. And environmentalists as a whole are very disappointed with the results of RARE 2. They think the acreage that the Forest Service is dedicating to wilderness is far too small. And for some of them, as you said, it's just the last straw. And that's when you get a group of disaffected activists, all of whom worked for major organizations.
That's right.
These were all people who had put in time with the Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth, etc. And they decide that there's something new is needed, and they want to energize the movement with more radical activism, and that's when they found Earth First, which is originally called Earth First, and then very soon after is called Earth First with a mandatory exclamation.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Earth First, or is exclamation point ER at the end of it.
Right.
One of the things about Earth First, it's dedicated to also direct action. And we were, and you mentioned before, you know, going up into trees to especially old growth redwoods and other forests in the West to prevent them from being cut down, spiking trees, which there is the most controversial thing. There is a book that was sort of an inspiration to the movement, Edward Abbey's The Monkey Wrench Gang.
Right.
Talk to me about that. That was sort of fascinating.
Yeah, Edward Abbey was in many ways the sort of original cultural guru of this, of Earth First and of the broader movement. And Abbey had been writing for many years before Earth First was founded. His most famous book was The Monkey Wrench Gang, which is a novel. His most famous piece of nonfiction writing was a collection of essays called Desert Solitaire. And Abbey was, a very prickly thinker and writer about the American West and about public lands especially. And he wrote, or at least... when I say Edward Abbey, I'm really sort of talking about the persona that he adopted when he wrote, right? Which by all accounts is very different from the actual Edward Abbey, who was a very quiet, sort of shy person. But, the persona that he wrote with, was frustrated and angry, and funny, and sometimes in a sort of a darkly humorous sense. But he wrote about the plight of the landscape that he loved in the West, and he felt that something more extreme was needed, that the National Park Service and the federal government and various land management agencies were not doing enough. And so he argued that citizen activism and direct action, grassroots activism was needed. And in The Monkey Wrench Gang, he gave a sort of a funny and a wild account of what that might look like. So the Monkey Wrench Gang is this group of four activists who tear across the West in the 1970s, trying to prevent development, and doing so by engaging in various forms of activism. I think when most people think of direct action, they think of civil disobedience.
Right.
So putting your body on the line and being out there very publicly. But the other form of direct action, what Abbey was writing about, was various forms of sabotage, what was also called ecotage and also called monkey wrenching after his novel. And this was more sort of behind the scenes, under the cover of night action, where you would sabotage bulldozers or road survey projects or whatnot in order to try to slow down or gum up the works of various forms of development.
It's interesting because when I was looking up on the web things about Earth First, I came across the printed symbol of the monkey wrench several times in their literature. And that actually became a symbol of it. Now, there is a lot to talk about Earth First, and that's a whole history we could spend a whole show on. One of the things that's interesting is the problem of defining wilderness and humanity and its relationship to each other. And that's one of the things that Earth First had to try to wrestle with, continually talk about that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's been a real criticism of Earth First, which I think is both an important criticism and at times an unfair criticism, and that is that Earth First sort of and Earth First style wilderness activists romanticize or even fetishize this thing called wilderness, right? And the idea that there are places that are pure or pristine, untouched by human beings, nature in its most sort of pure sense, and that's what we really need to protect. And the criticism, the very important criticism that's been made against that argument is that there is, in fact, no such thing as pristine nature. There is, a many millennia history of just about any part of the planet of human interaction with those places. And this idea of pristine wilderness is really an overly romantic view, and one that leads to potentially an anti-human and a deeply misanthropic view of environmentalism. I think that's a really important criticism, and one that I tried to really sort of keep in mind and foreground in the book, but also to say that I think it's to some degree overstated, because Earth Firsters, although they did talk in sometimes overly in overstated ways about wilderness, the purity of it and the importance of it. If you look at what they were actually doing on the ground, they were interested in all sorts of landscapes, and they were certainly interested in what a lot of environmental scholars now call working landscapes, which is arguably one of the most important places for environmental activism. So, for instance, they were not only concerned with Forest Service wilderness or National Park Service wilderness, they were also concerned with what's called the public domain, which is the Bureau of Land Management land. Most of this land is land that has worked. It's mined, it's grazed, it's farmed. And so these are landscapes that are always in the process of various forms of transformation and human interaction. And Earth Firsters were equally concerned with the use of those landscapes and what that use should look like. And so I think that the idea that they were obsessed with pristine wilderness is not really a fair accounting of what they were actually doing and thinking at the time.
We're almost completely out of time, and we have barely scratched the surface of this book. And I want to mention, there's so many nuanced, interesting philosophical, political histories that are in this book. It's fascinating, especially the relationship of the Earth Firsters to conservative land people. And that's a story for a whole other time. But I wanted to ask you before we sign off, where do you think ecocentrism is today? Is it on the rise again because of the state of what's going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can only sort of hazard an answer to it. I mean, we're getting into the, an area that historians
I know that.
Are supposed to plead ignorance of.
Well, taking your historian gown off.
Yeah.
But gut feelings. I mean, I feel like there's, as a matter of fact, I was just reading an article in the Times today that said a lot of young environmentalists are through working within the system.
Right.
And it sounded like people are getting re-radicalized again.
Yeah, I think so. I guess my answer would be that I'm not sure that ecocentrism, the philosophy in a strict sense, is making any sort of a comeback, because I think that a lot of climate change activists are fundamentally concerned with social justice,
right.
Inequality, and the human effects or the human consequences, the consequences for humans, rather, of climate change. But I do think that, as you're suggesting, direct action...
It's coming back.
Is coming back, yeah.
Yes,
people are sort of looking at what the U.S. government certainly, but also world governments have been able to do. It consistently falls short of what we know has to be done.
Yeah.
And if this is the existential issue that most of us believe it to be, the question becomes, what are we willing to do to change the direction?
Let's stop right there. We're out of time. We could talk forever about this book. My guest tonight is Keith Makoto Woodhouse, assistant professor at Northwestern University, where he teaches in the history department and the environmental policy and culture program. And we've been talking about his book, The Ecocentrists, A History of Radical Environmentalism. Keith, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to talk to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.